You're listening to the Apple Insider Podcast.
Welcome to episode 26 of our show, where we discuss the latest news about Apple, iPhone, iPad, Mac, and more. We're recording on Thursday, July 23rd, 2015. I'm your host, Victor Marks, and with me today are Neil Hughes, Managing Editor of Apple Insider. Hey, Neil.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Fantastic. And Mikey.
Hey, guys. What's up?
Yo. Right. So I want to tell you, our listeners, just a moment about VideoBlocks. VideoBlocks is an affordable subscription-based stock media site that gives you unlimited access to premium stock footage. You get great value with the unlimited download model, access to a library of over 100,000 HD clips, After Effects templates, and motion backgrounds, over 250,000 graphics. On average, subscribers pay less than $1 per download over the course of a year, and it's the same content that you would find on much more expensive stock sites. There's a great variety of time-lapse aerials, both U.S. and international locations, slow motion and nature shots, and more, and they're continuously adding new content to the library so that it stays fresh. Everything is 100% royalty-free with unrestricted usage rights for personal or commercial projects. You get to keep what you download and maintain usage rights forever. Want to know more? Go to videoblocks.com/promo/insider and sign up for your own subscription today. Now, in the news, we had the Apple earnings call. This was pretty huge, and there were a lot of people talking about it. There were people talking about how many watches were sold, how many iPads were sold, what the trends were, how much was spent on R&D. There was a lot to cover in this earnings call. Neil, what do you think is the point that people should take away from this huge earnings call? Let me just jump right in and nail you with that.
Get me started. All right, here's what you need to know about the earnings call. Wall Street is insane. Apple is the largest company on the planet. They grew their revenue by 33%. Let me restate that. The largest company on the planet grew their revenue by 33%. It's just like, it's insane how much they keep growing, and it means nothing to Wall Street because they have their idea of what they think the sales should be and where everything should be at. So Apple sold 47.5 million iPhones in their quarter. It was a record, but that wasn't enough for Wall Street because they expected it to be closer to 50 million in some cases, like Ming-Chi Kuo of KGI Securities. I think he had 54 million. Was it at, Mikey?
I'm checking that right now. I think it was around there, though, yeah.
Yeah, so the expectations were too high. The report came out. Apple had a record quarter. Investors don't care. And the stock tanks and drops, you know, like 7% the next day because of what? Because of some arbitrary made-up numbers that idiots on Wall Street came up with? You know,
Let me stop you there and ask a question. Apple gives guidance, right? Apple gives earning guidance. They say that they expect revenue to be within this and this, and they give an upper and lower, right?
Well, it's traditionally low, yes.
Well, they used to underestimate their guidance. So what happened was 3 years ago or whatever, they used to grossly underestimate their guidance. It was like a running joke on Wall Street. And then a few years ago, they changed how they report their guidance, and so now they give realistic guidance. And they're always within their guidance; it's accurate. But Wall Street doesn't care about that kind of stuff. You know, it's a game show over there, essentially, and people are throwing darts at a board, and they're picking numbers and saying, "Oh, this is where the iPhone sales are going to be." So even when they come in with this huge growth, it's not what they're expecting, and then the stock tanks. It's just silly. It's beyond stupid.
What I was looking at was I was looking at the guidance, and I was looking and seeing that they're still coming in above their upper mark on their guidance.
Yeah, they did this time. Sometimes they fall within it, but
not by much, right? It's not a drastic number. It's not millions and millions and millions upon millions of dollars above. It's a small amount above. They're clearly being much more accurate between what they're estimating and what they're reporting.
Yeah, they've been doing that for a few years now.
So when Wall Street gets fussy and decides that this is not right and tanks the stock, that for me and personally, and I'm not giving stock advice to any of our listeners, but for me, that's a sign, go and buy, right?
Right. I mean, disclose, I don't own any Apple stock. I don't own any technology company stock. I write about it for a living, and so I don't invest in it because that would be unethical of me. But anyhow, You know, just looking at it objectively as someone who, you know, has no financial gain from Apple's earnings, this is a company with over $200 billion in cash. I mean, think about that, right? You look at some of these companies and what their values are and you know, in relation to how much they make. You know, Apple is making cash. I mean, they're like rolling in it right now. They had net profit of $10.7 billion in this quarter. That was up from $7.4 billion a year ago. Their main product, the iPhone 6, is almost a year old, and they still sold 47.5 million iPhones in a three-month span. I mean, the numbers are astronomical. They're incredible. They're way up there. But Wall Street is a game, and that's why the stock tanks. It has no real reflection on the health of the company. You know, it has nothing to do with how profitable they are, how successful they are, how well they're doing. It's nothing about that. And people, you know, they look at, oh, maybe the iPhone 6S that's coming out isn't going to be as in demand because it's expected to have the same appearance and stuff like that. Oh, iPad sales are down, blah, blah, blah. I mean, this is the very definition of a healthy company. They're selling stuff with 40% margins. They're raking in cash. There's absolutely no reason for the stock to tank, but welcome to Wall Street.
Mikey, Apple, are they still doomed?
Well, I mean, they're always doomed, but it's kind of what makes it interesting, right? I mean, I'm sure these investors and hedge fund people have their reasons, and I'm sure their macroeconomics and all kinds of studies are way over my head. But I guess that the only thing that I can think of that they're thinking is that there's a slowdown, I guess, in iPad, and you know they're kind of hesitant about Apple Watch, and they're seeing some other outside factors that Apple has no control over, as far as consumer direction is concerned. And you know, I guess every earnings call they just get the kind of cold feet and bail on it, whereas you know it'll correct itself in a couple of days. It's already starting to. I mean, this happens every 3 months, so really it's not anything new,
right?
And it's all about growth. That's what it is. That's all they care about. Are you growing? And I mean, then you look at Apple and it's like 33% growth in revenue. Yeah, they're growing all right. You know, they're doing well.
Except they didn't grow as much as last
quarter.
Right,
and they may not grow as much next quarter because, and it's like, oh my goodness, you know, it's out of control.
Right. Well, what we're talking about is people looking at a very short term, and what you and I talk about, right? What all three of us think about is a much longer term, right? We talk about.
Well, they're looking at longer term too. It's all BS numbers, though. Like, I'll get these analyst reports that come in, and they're projecting what iPhone sales are going to be in 2018. I mean, come on. Seriously? You know, like, we have no idea what the market trends are going to be. We have no idea what the phone is going to look like. You know, I mean, it's ridiculous that they make projections this far out, but this is what they do. This is the game they're in.
That's like my favorite line from The Simpsons. You know, it was Disco Stu saying, disco sales for the year 1975 were up 500%. If that trend continues, hey.
It's fake numbers built on fake numbers built on fake numbers. And if you extrapolate all this fuzzy math, it's just built on nothing.
Well, it's really hard for tech, you know, tech investor or tech analysts to actually, you know, analyze an industry that is inherently changing literally every day. So I guess they do what they can. And when I see their reports and I see their forecasts, it's such a huge spread on the from the highs and lows, and you know, whether the stock is overweight or not. I see why they have jobs, but then again, it's kind of like some of this stuff, it's ethereal. You can't really you can't put your finger on it, and I don't know. Just listening to their questions at the call, right? It was kind of humorous, especially Gene Munster.
I don't know how you can take this stuff seriously. If you look back like 5 years ago, IDC, you know, these companies that people invest based on this stuff, and companies like IDC were making projections that Nokia's Symbian was going to maintain like 90% control of the smartphone market. And like, I remember they were saying that Windows Phone, when it was announced, was going to overtake iOS and things like this.
I remember that.
And it's just like, do they? I think they just like think that momentum or this or that or just, you know, through sheer will, maybe Microsoft was going to do something. I don't know. But you look at these things and it's like, I don't know how anybody could have in good faith made that recommendation with a straight face, because even if you feel comfortable that something is going to happen, you don't know, right? I mean, I could sit here and say, well, I would imagine that iOS, you know, is still going to be around 5 years from now and will still have a pretty hefty portion of the smartphone market, but maybe not. Maybe something is going to change drastically in technology in the next 5 years that I could never envision. You can't make those kind of predictions, especially that far out. If you're going to project what iPhone sales are going to be in 2018, you're smoking something.
Teasing. It's going to be teasing all the way.
Teasing, right.
Dude. Oh, I'm sorry. You were offering to smoke something?
You smoking teasing?
Dude. That's the Korean best.
It's a new strain.
At any rate, so the watch obviously hasn't had a chance to really show what it can do in terms of sales growth because we haven't hit its first Christmas season yet. The tablet,
we don't even know how many it's sold.
Do you have an estimate? What's your guess?
Well, that's part of the insanity of this, right? Everybody this week was coming out with their projections on what they think that the Apple Watch sales were based on what Tim Cook said. The problem is they didn't actually listen to what Tim Cook said. If you look at what was said, they said that over the first 7 weeks or whatever, the Apple Watch outsold the first iPhone and the first iPad. Here's what we know. The first iPad sold 3 million in 90 days. And they sold 2 million somewhere around there, you know, like 60 days or something like that, right? And then so people were saying, oh, I think the watch sold 1.9 million units. Did you even listen to what Tim Cook said or anybody from the company actually said? They didn't give any hard sales, but they specifically said that it outpaced the iPad. And here you are saying that you thought it sold less than 2 million when we know for a fact that it sold more than 2 million based on what they said. It's crazy.
Well, I mean, but their numbers of averaging watch sales to $500 can't be wrong because we all know everyone is buying the stainless steel version.
Again, it's fake numbers built on fake numbers with fake numbers. You look at fake numbers for the watch sales combined with fake numbers for the average selling price, and then you come up with fake numbers on the margins, and then you come to a conclusion based on that. In what reality does this make any sense, right? There's nothing that's there that's actually scientific other than just the math itself. But it's all made with BS numbers.
Yeah, well, I mean, the math itself, it can't be. I mean, there's really no way to extrapolate because of the incredibly widespread of models. I mean, you have the sport model starting, you know, down in the 400s, and then you have, you know, the edition at the, you know, tens of thousands. How are you going to compensate? What are you going to comp for that?
You have to come up with a starting presumption that says we think the greatest distribution of these was.
Yeah, but
most
already
sport, most steel. And yes, that's
a
presumption.
You're already guessing.
Yes,
you're
it's a presumption.
And you can't make averages. I mean, it would be better if there was like an iPhone, like there was three models that were separated by a couple hundred dollars difference, not thousands of dollars. You know, it's kind of impossible to.
Well,
do
you think many edition watch models were sold, or do you think that the greatest bulk of that distribution was steel and aluminum?
There's no history to build this on. We have no idea. Yeah. It's a new product category, a new product, new price points, new everything. I mean, you can't look at this and say, oh, well, it's probably this or that, because nobody knows. Nobody has any idea except for Apple.
I think
I pulled the numbers here. So Bloomberg said the average analyst thought that Apple sold 1.9 million watches in the quarter. But here's the problem. They said that it outpaced the iPad, and the first iPad sold 2 million units 8 weeks after launch. So if you extrapolate the numbers, then at 58 days after launch, the watch would have been at about 2.15 million. And then Tim Cook said sales accelerated in June. So, I mean, you could be as high as 3 million. So how can anybody honestly say that they think it sold 1.9 million units in a quarter when Apple said that it didn't sell that few? It's just
because
people are being willfully ignorant.
Slice says so, that's why.
All
right. Right, yeah.
What we're saying is that the largest number of idiots outnumber people who listen to Tim Cook, and therefore,
yes.
Yeah. Okay, is that a great surprise that there are a large number of idiots?
No, it's not a surprise at all. This is the same thing that's been going on for a long time. Apple didn't give any exact specifics on the sales, but they said enough that we can have an idea of where it's at. And it's probably for the quarter somewhere between like 2.5-3 million units probably was where it was at. And we can't say for sure because they're not going to tell us.
All right. Let's talk about something else. We want to talk about – we were talking about Apple Watch. Tell me about customer sat.
Well, Apple says that it's off the charts, that it's, 97% is what they revealed.
Right. They said that was higher than people were happy with the original iPhone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it would seem that early adopters of the Apple Watch are exceedingly happy with the product. And we know that Tim Cook takes customer satisfaction very seriously. He repeatedly mentions it with the iPad, even though the sales have been declining. You know, he says that he thinks people are going to come back and they'll buy. It's just a longer upgrade cycle. So I would say, obviously, with a satisfaction rating that high, it bodes well for the future of the Apple Watch for potentially new customers or people upgrading their existing models.
And the thing about that number, because a lot of people read that number and also read it wrongly, that number says that of the people that bought the Apple Watch, 97% of those people are completely pleased with it, right? That's what that means. Okay, there were a ton of people that I was talking with on Twitter that completely misunderstood that, and they were trying to figure out how a number would involve people who had not bought the watch. You know, they were thinking it was 97% of people responded favorably to the watch. No, no, it's of the people that bought the thing, 97% like it.
People are generally pretty happy with it, and that's been my experience with people that I know that own it and I've talked to. People are generally pretty happy with it. They say it's a pretty good device, and I feel pretty much the same way. I mean, the price points aside, I don't know how much I could recommend it to, you know, someone like my parents, you know, at $350, $400. But if somebody's really on the market for a smartwatch and a fitness device, it's a great choice.
I've known a bunch of people in San Francisco who wear the who bought the watch day one and gave up on it like in 2 or 3 weeks because it wasn't the Jesus watch they were expecting.
Well,
And what was interesting about this customer sat report was that it seemed like people out in the rest of the world really love the thing, and it was just the people in San Francisco and in the Valley who expected it to be the Jesus watch were depressed that it wasn't the second coming.
That's not surprising, right? I mean, when the iPad was announced, it was a giant iPod Touch. It was a disappointment amongst tech people.
Well, yeah.
As was the iPhone.
Right.
To a lesser degree, but I mean, still.
Yeah, I think that tech enthusiasts are always going to have high expectations because especially people that are upgrading their phone every year and all that, we all want the next gee whiz features and stuff, and that's just not what Apple does.
Nope. Yeah, people should know by now that the first anything of Apple is not the thing that makes the product so popular or that lineup so popular. It's going to be the S, or it's going to be the second gen. You know, it's going to be the follow up after they get all this information. Then they're going to come out with something that fixes everything and adds on the features, and everyone's happy.
Well, I disagree a little bit, and here's why. We used to say when we were talking about old Microsoft that anything with old Microsoft, you had to wait for the third version for them to get it right. With iPhone, the very first version, I don't care how many things you point out were wrong with it. Yes, it didn't do picture messaging. Yes, there were no apps, all of those things. Yes, it was not a great communications device. It was amazing, and I loved it, and I was perfectly happy with what it was at the time. And
yeah, I mean, I don't
have to wait for version 2 for that.
Yeah, I think that you look at the first iPhone, and that certainly laid the groundwork for everything. And the things that it was missing were 3G, I think, probably being the biggest.
Or MMS, or copy and paste, or apps. Or there's a long list of things that we got eventually.
Some software, some hardware. Yeah, I think that the Apple Watch it reminds me of the iPhone in a lot of ways in that sense. I don't think the Apple Watch will ever be as successful as the iPhone. But I do think that it reminds me of it in a lot of ways, where you can see where the groundwork is laid in the obvious places that they're going to go with it. You know, obviously, it's lacking. You could compare lacking GPS in this first-gen version to lacking 3G in the first iPhone, right? That's a natural hardware progression. And then software, figuring out what the apps need to be and what's going to work for people running native apps, fitness apps, that kind of stuff. And that's all eventually going to come, and some of it's coming as soon as this fall.
Mm-hmm. Are you running 2 on your, or watchOS 2 on your watch?
I am not running watchOS 2. I have heard that it's exceptionally buggy, especially as far as Apple betas go. So I have held off because I wear my watch every day and I exercise with it. So I do want to test it out, and I'm hoping to potentially get some betas of upcoming fitness apps to test out and see how those run natively on it. Because, of course, right now, if I don't run with my phone, which I don't, then I can't use things like Runkeeper and stuff like that. So I'm excited to see how those apps kind of take it in a different direction and see what they do with fitness-oriented stuff.
You know, I was talking with a fellow yesterday who wrote me from his phone and said, I'm writing this short email. My computer's crashed. I need to write more when I get back on my computer and get it working again. And it's just a coincidence that one of our sponsors today is Backblaze. Backblaze is online backup for your documents, music, photos, videos, and user data. And please go to backblaze.com/appleinsider to get a no-risk free 2-week trial. Over 150 petabytes of data have been backed up for their customers. Backing up is easy. Restoring data is complicated. That's traditionally the problem, right? It's easy to back up a data, but if you have a backup that you can't restore from, you've accomplished absolutely nothing. Backblaze has restored over 10 billion files. You have online access to your files from anywhere you have an internet connection, and they have iPhone and Android apps for mobile files access. You can restore one file, you can restore all of your files. They have an easy web restore interface and also have USB hard drives available for larger stores. They're founded by ex-Apple engineers, and Backblaze runs natively on Mac and PC, external hard drives included. No add-ons, no gimmicks, no additional charges. They're just $5 a month per computer for unlimited, unthrottled backup. If you're already backing up, if you already have a Time Machine backup, if you already have a Drobo, if you have some other method, backing up with another method like Backblaze is like investing. It's more diversification. You have multiple backups, so if one happens to fail on you, you've got another backup to go from. So you should really consider, back that Mac up. Get your free trial by going to backblaze.com/appleinsider.
Back that Mac up?
That's what they wrote in the copy.
All right. I like it.
And speaking of things that are backing up, the iPhone 6S, rumored device, rear case, or back, allegedly features stronger construction.
Yeah, this aligns with what has been rumored, that they're going to use the same Series 7000 aluminum that's in the Apple Watch.
And externally, the device is going to look the same as the iPhone 6 that I'm holding in my hot little hand right now.
Correct.
But internally, it's going to be a different, well, it's going to be a different material for internal and external, but internally that's probably also going to have a different different layout inside to give it that extra structural support.
And this is why when we were talking last week about the new iPod Touch, and I was saying that I could see the iPhone 6 components getting squeezed down into an iPod Touch style 4-inch device. I think that Apple doesn't want to have identical looking devices in the lineup at the $200 and $100 price points. So the fact that the 6S is going to look identical to the 6 means that they will probably sunset the 6 this fall. That would be my guess.
That seems reasonable.
So then you would have a so-called 6C at the $99 price point with the components from the 6 just crammed into a smaller phone.
Okay, so you have the iPod Touch, you have a 6C, and
a free iPhone 5S, free on contract.
Okay, so let's do this in order because I want to keep this straight. So we have an iPod Touch, we have an iPhone 5S...
Yes.
We have a 6C.
Yep.
We have a 6S and a 6S Plus.
Right.
Okay. And the 5S is hanging around because it's free and doesn't have Touch ID or Apple Pay in it.
It does have Touch ID. It doesn't have Apple Pay. And this is what we've debated
before.
The 5S
doesn't have Touch ID? They're going to take Touch ID out of that thing?
No, it does have Touch ID.
Okay.
It does have.
Okay.
Yeah. But it doesn't have Apple Pay.
Correct. Yeah. Unless
but
they did some serious.
But we debated this before, right? How aggressively do they want to push Apple Pay?
My vote is for very.
I know that that's your vote. I don't think so because I think they just keep it the same.
Okay, so but even so, this is still a very transitional product line if we're talking about Apple Pay, and let's say one more cycle after this, the 5S goes away completely, and we have
a free 6C. A 6S at $100 and then a 7 at $200. That would be a presumed 2016 lineup.
Right. So essentially a year or so away gets us a fully Touch ID, fully Secure Element, fully Apple Pay lineup.
Right. I see that happening starting fall 2016. I think the 5S is going to stay the same.
Okay.
That's just a guess.
Well, it's a good speculation. I mean, the thing that I think about with these transitions, and we saw transitions before, right? We saw the how quickly can Apple transition away from 30-pin to Lightning. We right. saw – and that was a transition that was a little bit harder because it involved third parties and third-party devices and hardware.
Right.
It was still a very aggressive transition. Right, it moved very quickly. The only thing that hung around with 30-pin was the iPod Classic for a while, mm-hmm. and the iPad 2, which hung around right. because of education.
Right.
So, moving Touch ID is a transition that happens on their own timeline. They do it as fast or as slow as they like, and I think it's probably one timed well with the amount of banks and shops as they get on board with it.
And I think Apple Pay makes for a good upsell, too. You want Apple Pay, spend a little more.
Well,
they can kind of take their time rolling out on the product. And you can even get an iPhone 5S and pair it with an Apple Watch and get Apple Pay.
Yeah, you can. Although the question is, does that make sense for the consumer that's got the 5S, and why wouldn't they just go ahead and get the more expensive phone?
Maybe they want the watch, yeah. And a 5S at $450 would be $200 cheaper than a 6S. So you could take that $200 and put it toward a watch. I could see some people doing that.
Okay. You know, I hadn't really
thought
of it that way.
Let's not forget that 5S is still a great phone. I mean, it's not like anybody would buy a 5S. And I mean, it's still got the 64-bit processor, Retina display, Touch ID, good camera.
And that screen size that you love so much.
And it's 4 inches, right, Neil?
That screen size.
No. I want the 3.5-inch screen. I want to go back to the small screen. If they made an iPhone the size of the iPod Nano, I would be all about it.
You know, I remember in 2008 when we'd had the first iPhone for a little while, one of the product discussions that I was involved in with one of the third-party resellers that I used to work at, not third-party resellers, third-party accessory maker that I used to work at, was the rumor at the time was that Apple was going to make a mini iPhone.
Right.
And yeah. we were getting these hoax devices from China
right.
that were mini iPhones, and they were run by cheesy cell phone OSs that had existed for a while. You know, things that had Java inside them and stuff like that, or even there was one that was a really terrible version of Android, I think. And they were miniature iPhone looking things with a miniature home button and everything, trying to pretend to be the mini iPhone, and it just took us this number of years to get to the point where we realize Apple always made the mini iPhone. It was just the first version.
I mean, that's one way of looking at it. But, I think that you have to think, right, that Apple toyed with the idea in their labs. I mean, why wouldn't they, right? I'm sure that somewhere there was some concept for a pretty small phone if they felt like there was a market there for it. But obviously the market went in an opposite direction. And the market stumbled almost into these larger phones. You got to remember, when the big phones first started coming out, it was to put in larger batteries because they were the first ones with the LTE. And the LTE early chips were horrible battery life. And so they went with bigger phones to accommodate that. And then it turned out consumers actually liked bigger phones, and that's why we're at where we are today. And now, you know, nobody's selling phones in the 4-inch range except for Apple, basically.
Well, early on, back in those days, those 2008, 2009, 2010 days, some of the very early Motorola Droid and other Verizon-branded Droid products were smaller devices. The Moto Droid was actually a nice size, but some of the other products, like the HTC Droid that was back then, were tiny. They were so small, and they had touchscreens, but you could not type on them, or at least I certainly
right.
couldn't. We learned that small devices don't work.
Well, we were just coming out of that stage of, you know, the StarTAC and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, we still had that kind of mindset of smaller is better.
Yeah, the Razer was as thin as you could make it, nice and
yeah.
tiny.
And then enter iPhone with a soft keyboard, and people realize that their fat fingers can no longer activate the hitboxes on their
I remember discussions of the iPhone, the original iPhone, being too large for jeans pants pockets.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we have the 6 and the 6 Plus, and they fit perfectly well.
No, they don't.
That's just because you want the 3.5 inch device.
Neil wears skinny jeans. Come on.
You know, thinking about this iPhone mini or iPhone nano or whatever you want to call it, kind of reminds me now of how long have we been talking about an iPad Pro, a 12-inch iPad, right? 12.9-inch iPad.
Has it been about 2 years?
2 years? 3 years? I'm starting to wonder. I mean, I still think it's coming, but part of me wonders if it's just like one of those mythical products that Apple really has no intention of releasing.
The thing that existed in the labs and we never saw
it. Yeah. And like, you know, they toyed around with it and it was like, yeah, there's not really a market for this thing.
7 years from now, a prototype pops up on eBay for 10 minutes and...
The Apple TV, an upgrade is inevitable, right? I mean, it's an established product. It hasn't been updated in a while.
It's a hobby, Neil.
But we know that they're working on negotiations for a TV streaming deal. All this stuff leaked ahead of time. And anytime Apple has to talk to partners, then stuff leaks out. The iPad Pro, they don't have to make any partnerships or really do anything. And we constantly wonder who would this be for, what's the market. I could see it being a good laptop replacement if Apple does it right, and I still think it's coming, but I wonder, is it really coming?
Well, but that's one of the things that I observed about the earnings call, is that after looking at the way that devices sell and the sort of sales cycles for those things, I kind of feel like the iPad and tablet space, and when I talk about those, they're almost interchangeable, that the iPad is more akin to being a PC cycle or a computer cycle for sales cycles and replacement than the phone cycle.
Absolutely.
In which case, the iPad Pro as a laptop replacement does make sense. You are right, sir. I concede.
I think
it's doing well in enterprise. I mean,
it
would. Yeah. You know.
How big's that market, though?
I don't know. I mean, Apple could tap into it. It's
IBM.
It's something. Yeah, I mean, it's something that they've been toying around with. Maybe they could go wholeheartedly into enterprise like they did with education.
I think it needs an exceptional keyboard dock, and you know the rumored stylus support would be a big part of it too, and I could see that appealing in a lot of. I mean, imagine if you had a iPad Pro with NFC in it, as it's rumored to have, and it would be an Apple Pay receiving thing, and you could replace a terminal anywhere, basically.
So you've
got a grocery store.
The most expensive register ever.
Well, that would be one use for it.
They're going to kill Square Register.
Yeah.
Imagine.
Oh, God.
Imagine. Register. But imagine that you could have a device like that where it could be used in a number of dynamic settings. It could be with a keyboard dock, a laptop replacement. It could be a cash register. It could be something, you know, you're drawing on and doing stuff. You know, for professional style uses like that in a workplace, enterprise. I think that's what everybody feels like an iPad Pro would be, enterprise. But who knows? I mean, it may just be a smoke and mirrors. It may be nothing.
So have you been using the iOS 9 beta on your iPad? This is my transition here.
Yes.
Because we know that there are all these cool things for iPad in iOS 9 that would make sense on a supposed iPad Pro. But we have them today on your iPad Air 2.
Picture-in-picture is pretty amazing.
Picture-in-picture, the slide-over.
Slide-over. Mm-hmm.
The keyboard support.
Mm-hmm.
The side-by-side app use.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is why I think an iPad Pro is coming, because you see these features being added in there, and it's kind of like, oh, iPad sales are declining, longer upgrade cycle, people are using these more like PCs, and I think Apple kind of got the hint to give it a little more attention and give it more PC-style functionality. And you're seeing it coming now, and it's awesome. Yeah, okay, some of it was already on Android and stuff like that, but... you know, you have the largest app ecosystem on iPad. You have the best designed apps. You have the best hardware. And so now you're getting these features. And I've been testing it for a few weeks now, and it's awesome. I love it.
So tell me, Beta 4 was just released. What do you think?
It's buggy. Install it at your own risk. I have it on my daily phone, but it does have its share of issues. So I have it on, I have the public beta on my iPhone, which is the same as the developer beta 4, and then I have developer beta 4 on my iPad. For some reason, it runs really well on my iPad Air 2, and it runs buggy on my iPhone. And it may just be because I use my iPhone more and I'm noticing. But, like, for example, I installed public beta 2 this week, and I've been having issues with the keyboard. The keyboard, when it works with iMessage, kind of gets wonky and stuff. So it's a beta. Don't install it unless you really, really, really want to.
What's your feeling about having public betas? Because we saw that one of the things that happened this week was that Apple turned off the ability to submit reviews on iTunes, the App Store, for things that when you're submitting from a beta OS.
Thank God they did.
They failed to do it from the Mac App Store if you're writing from El Cap.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it doesn't affect them as much, I don't think.
Right.
I feel like people are more apt to put a public beta on their phone than they are a computer that they use every day. It seems like a more dire situation if your computer crashes than your phone.
Not if you use our sponsor Backblaze, apparently.
True. I wish I used something like that, or made my own backup for my iPhone, which erased itself after I installed the developer beta 4, which was great.
Yeah, just what you wanted was to have things erase themselves. But I wonder, does it kind of send a message to developers for the Mac App Store that, you know, they're not kept in the same light or held with the same regard as the iOS App Store developers?
Well, I don't know. I saw it. I forgot who. I think it might have been Jason Snell or something. Somebody tweeted out about the Mac App Store being a second-class citizen in Apple's eyes. And it is true. It doesn't get the attention that it might. You know, it definitely is not as updated, and, you know, it doesn't have as many features as the iOS version. But then again, I question how many users there are on the Mac version compared to the iOS version. I mean, we have to remember that iOS market share is ridiculous, and Mac is also growing, but it's still not anywhere near the number of users of iPhones and iPads and iPods or iPod touches.
I want to say this. Numbers aside, the Mac App Store is great for the end user. When you get a brand new Mac for the first time, you take it home, mm-hmm. it's configured to allow applications to be installed from the Mac App Store. Sandboxed, secure, nice. You know that if you go to the Mac App Store, that the applications you get there are more than likely going to be safe. They are coming from a reputable source. They aren't going to screw things up. And on the whole, you can trust them. For developers, it's a great thing because you don't have to worry about how you push updates. And as a user, you don't have to worry about how you're going to get updates. And the price for developers that they can charge is better than any money they can make on the iOS side of things. So right. It seems to me that this is something that ought to be pushed, that it ought to be taken care of and tended to and curated and given the love that it really needs. And yeah. It's not.
Yeah. I mean, I rarely go on the Mac App Store. I usually download my stuff directly from developers' websites because I've found that the things that I want to download are not yet on the Mac App Store. It's mm-hmm. The review process is either, you know,
right,
they're dragging their feet, or you know, they're understaffed, or you know, sometimes developers just don't even want to bother going through that whole step by step red tape process. So I mean, they need to do something. They need to make the process more transparent and streamlined for the developer, and then, you know, I mean,
yeah,
hopefully we'll see some support for that in the future.
As an end user, I search for an application through the Mac App Store. I search for the problem I'm trying to solve, and then I'll look through the apps and find the one that I feel like suits my needs best. And 50-50, I'll buy it through the App Store, or if I'm really thinking about it, I will go to the developer's website and purchase directly from them. And I do that because I would rather give the developer the full price instead of giving Apple the 30% cut.
Mm.
But I do it 50-50 because I like the idea of getting the updates and being able to reinstall directly from the App Store and seeing my purchased list and not having to chase down all these individual websites or manage product keys or any of the other stuff that you have to do when you're buying outside of the App Store.
Yeah, I think a big problem too is promotional opportunities and upgrade opportunities and stuff like that. A lot of developers, if you already had a previous version of the app, you get the new one at a discount when they release a new one. And there aren't really ways to do that on any app store that Apple has right now. Updates come out and people just feel entitled to get them. And if you want to have new software, the app developer has to release a new version and then charge you for it. It's kind of a wonky system.
Yeah.
It would be nice if they could make – like how about cross-buy on iPhone and Mac? That would be great, right?
Mm-hmm.
Bundle Pixelmator for Mac and for iPhone. Get a discount if you buy both. You know, that would be awesome. Let's have a little bit more.
One password across all of these things? Yes.
Yeah, let's have a little more fluidity between the platforms. They have that in other areas, right? They're kind of blurring the lines between OS X and iOS. Let's blur them further, and let's blur the lines on the app stores.
I guess one step at a time. I don't know if it's in there.
No, you know when this is going to happen? This is going to happen when Apple decides that they have a major update to Final Cut or something like that coming out, and they want people to upgrade from Final Cut, you know, Pro as it is now to whatever the next version is, right? And so then, when it matters to them, is when they'll address the problem.
You mean when they nerf Final Cut even more than it is now?
Yeah.
Maybe. I mean, well, they've been given software away for free, right? They're not charging for iWork anymore, anything like that, if you buy a new iPhone. So maybe they're going in opposite direction. It's just all the software is going to be free.
Could be. I'd still pay for a quality product rather than download a free version of a subpar product. I mean,
I agree.
I think most people would prefer that method.
No, they wouldn't.
Well, that's
most people are idiots.
Yes.
Most people want it free. Most people want it cheap. Most people don't
care. They haven't
seen
the light. Maybe it's because they haven't tried the
cheap, fast,
the quality,
good pick two.
Quality kush.
Well, I mean, you look at the Apple Insider app, which you can download for free on the iOS App Store, was not compatible with the first few iOS 9 betas. And
oh, really?
Then,
We got reports.
Did we?
Yes, we got reports.
Oh, interesting.
People were unhappy with us. Which is not surprising, but still, people were.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, we had people emailing, and then leaving reviews on the App Store saying, don't bother downloading, it doesn't work on iOS 9. And it's like, this is a problem with a public beta. It's a bunch of people that don't understand that it's for testing. And, you know, that hurt our app. So if you go on there, the reviews are poor because people go on there and they complain and they don't like, you know, that it doesn't work and they feel entitled.
They tested it.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah. You've tested it. Thank you for reviewing it. Appreciate it.
We still can't do anything until September.
Right.
So, yeah.
It was a step in the right direction to block the reviews.
Well, we talked about how Mikey likes to pay for quality software and is willing to pay for a good product. And I want to talk about another good product that is kindly sponsoring the show for us today. That is Alarm.com. Alarm.com is the leading cloud-based smart home technology provider with over 25 million devices and sensors on their platform, trusted by over 2.3 million subscribers to protect their homes and businesses. Alarm.com technology is more reliable and secure than other systems, and they always have a 100% dedicated cellular connection into your home, so you're not vulnerable to cut lines or a down broadband connection. All Alarm.com connections and accounts are professionally monitored, so a real person at a central monitoring station will help get emergency response to your home in case of an emergency. They've got a top-rated mobile app to control your security, thermostat, and video monitoring, lights, locks, and garage door, so you're not bouncing between five or six different apps. And Alarm.com systems are professionally installed or maintained by a trusted local security expert, so it means you'll have time to relax on the weekend. You don't have to fuss with installing the thing. If you're interested in a smart home, sign up for smart home security this month and receive a free smart thermostat. Go to Alarm.com to find your local security dealers and enter promo code APPLE. Alarm.com, safe home, smart living. And we thank them for sponsoring the show today.
Kevin Lynch believes in Alarm.com.
Did you like that demo?
I thought it was pretty cool.
Yeah,
it was one of the new features that got me kind of excited about Apple Watch, or reignited my passion. Seeing him open that garage door, it's pretty sweet.
Yeah, having the camera and the garage door and the communication with his daughter all at the same time was pretty slick.
It was. It was nice. Almost as slick as that Segway, by the way.
Thank you.
It was nice.
But you tried out another product that
I did
wasn't as slick.
Oh, are you talking about El Coin.
I'm talking about the coin.
Yeah.
Now, I'm a fan of payment products. I like the idea of innovation in payment systems and things like this. I love Apple Pay. I love the idea of all of these things. And you are not a fan of Coin.
Well, no, I wasn't initially a fan. But, I mean, there's a learning curve to it that I didn't expect.
Okay, so let's back up a step. What is Coin?
Okay, so Coin, it's basically a digital credit card, if you will. It's a smart connected credit card. It's the size of a credit card. It's as thin as one, but you can load on up to 8 different credit, debit, or loyalty cards.
How do you select one of those 8?
Well, if you're using just the coin itself, it has a button on it, and it'll a little e-ink display that will show you the last 4 digits and other pertinent information about the card, and you can cycle through them that way. Or you can connect with your phone and select from there, which is also a fairly painless process.
So if you're using it, that's something you would select before you were in line waiting to pay for something, and then you'd have the card ready.
Yeah, so it's kind of like it's akin to Apple Pay in that you choose your card, like if you have multiple cards in Apple Pay's
wallet.
Passbook or wallet, as they now call it, you select one, and then it says ready for a touch, and in Coin's case, ready for scan, and you just you swipe it with Coin.
So they are using the MagStripe technology, and you actually swipe it through the MagStripe reader.
Correct.
Okay. So why are you down on this thing? Because to me, it sounds like that's cool.
It is a really great idea, and especially great when it was first announced 2 years ago. And I finally got mine recently.
Has it been 2 years?
It was 2013, so not quite 2 years. A few months shy of a full 2 years, but it's been... So remember, when they were in the development process, they announced that they're delaying the shipping product for a full year as they go through design changes. And that's why I just recently got mine after pre-ordering it in 2013 when they announced. So it's been a while.
And how is it in actual use? What actually happens when you go to make a transaction?
Well, in most cases, when I first started using it and was loading cards up on my phone, it was having trouble... Or I was having trouble entering the swipe process correctly. So it takes a certain speed. You know, credit cards nowadays, I mean, you can swipe with reckless abandon, basically. But with Coin, you need to swipe it at a certain speed. It has to be consistent because of the internal electronics that are dynamically changing the mag stripe. So that's the learning curve that I was talking about. So, you know, when I first got it and I was trying to load up my cards, I was having problems with one card especially, trying to scan it in and sync it over to Coin, which is why I was initially not so pleased with it.
Once you got them all in, how did it work?
Once I got them all in, it works most of the time at the stores now. When I first started using it, like I said... It would come back with an error or a card not recognized. So even, you know, after cycling through basically all my cards, each one was not being recognized by the point of sale system. So I deduced that it was probably user error on my part. So I tried different scanning speeds, you know, swipe speeds, and found out that, you know, a good match, and it just works now. So I'm more happy with it than I was previously, but it's still not as easy as Apple Pay.
Right. And some of the people that were writing about the commenting on your review of it say that this thing is terrible and it's obsolete before it began. Why should anyone look at it?
Well, I mean, in my neck of the woods, we don't really have a lot of support for Apple Pay. We have Whole Foods and, you know, the big stores like that. But there's not many of them. There's not one you know, down the street from me. Down the street from me is a mom and pop shop who may get Apple Pay, you know, 10 years from now, who knows. So for people who live in areas where, or frequent stores that aren't yet up with the latest NFC POS systems, coin is a good option for now. Now, when Chip and Pin EMV comes out in September or October, was it? I'm not sure.
October.
You know, coin could become, start to become obsolete, but not immediately because, you know, they have to roll out the hardware, the POS hardware, and stores have to begin, you know, accepting, taking responsibility for those types of systems.
Right. Well, the new EMV hardware is actually both. It's MagStripe and EMV slot. So right. We're in that of transitional course, period where coin is going to keep working even after those systems come.
Right. Except the risk falls on the merchant at that point, right?
When right. Once if you use MagStripe, the risk assigns to the merchant instead of the card issuing service.
Yeah. So I mean, I could see merchants say, you know, no swipes. I mean, we do support it, but
I don't know. That may be a part of their merchant agreement where they can't refuse that.
I see. Well, also part of their merchant agreement now is that they can't ask you to corroborate whether you own the card or not by bringing out another ID. But of course,
that's been for a long time. Yeah. And of course, every merchant asks for it, and you have to challenge them on it if you actually intend to.
I never sign any of my credit cards, and it's never been an issue. So,
right? Do you ever get asked for a driver's license?
Sometimes, yeah.
Yeah, have you ever told them no?
Not usually. I haven't told them no. But
I know a fellow, a good friend of mine, who every time someone he doesn't sign the card, and every time someone asks for it, he says you can't ask for that.
Does he carry around a slip of paper printed out from
He does not carry the merchant agreement with him. He doesn't carry the cardholder rules, but he cites them, and they frown. They go talk to someone else and come back and say, "Okay, sir," and they take care of the transaction.
That is a man who really, really wants to have a fight.
He stands on principle, darn it.
Yeah, he's a principled man.
So principled.
And he's a great guy. He really is. Although, I have to say, there was one time he really ought to have been stopped. He was he has an assistant, and he was using the assistant's card at a place instead of his own card by accident. And no one questioned him when he had a name that clearly didn't match up with his gender or appearance.
Well, I'm getting a coin sent to me, thanks to Mikey, because I guess they gave him an extra one for ordering so early.
Nice.
They're sending me one. I'm excited to try it because I'm very minimalist in what I carry in my pockets, and I want to get rid of my credit cards. So this thing works in the places where I would want to use it, that's awesome. But one of my questions for you, Mikey, about the coin is, obviously it's a digital thing and has to have a battery in it, but they make it as thin as possible. Is it thin enough to fit into, for example, like a machine? Like I live in New York.
Yeah, it works in ATMs, and it is a credit card, but it just should be noted that it's fragile, so you can't. I mean, if you bend it, you break it.
Well, I just mean like those machines that actually suck the card in, you know, and hold it in there. Yeah.
Automated teller machines and your Metro machines.
Yeah, it's as thin as a credit card.
And does it work with ATM? So, for example, I can get cash out from my ATM.
Yeah, if you load in your debit card or your ATM card or whatever, right, it should work. Yeah,
see, that's awesome.
I mean, it's cool.
I don't think my bank is going to support Apple Pay for ATMs anytime soon, right? That doesn't seem like it's in the works. So, I mean, cards aren't going anywhere anytime soon. So, I think people are too easily writing this product off. If it works. But I've read stuff about people having it not work.
Yeah. So. It kind of depends on the user, I think. I mean, I've also read reviews that say, you know, this thing is a POS, the other kind of POS.
Right.
But
right.
I think it's just a user. It's a user issue if it doesn't really work for you. It's not the most user-friendly device, I'd say. I mean, there's a learning curve, like I said. So, but once you learn how to swipe with it, it really hasn't failed me.
But you're talking about swiping it when putting in, or swiping it when paying for something?
Yeah, no, swiping it when paying for something.
See, that's a nightmare, though. I mean, because how often do you swipe your own card versus somebody else swiping your card, right? I mean, if I go to a restaurant and I hand this thing over to somebody and they go back to the mystery room. Yeah, they go back to a mystery room and swipe the card. And meanwhile, they're back there pissed off at the card and they're swiping it 8,000 times and jamming this thing and they're going to break it. Yeah. That sounds like a terrible product to me.
Yeah, and well, it's not just the restaurant where people swipe your card, right? Every time you go up to a point of sale system and you don't swipe it right the first time, the person at the register is more likely than not going to take your card and swipe it for you just because they don't have the patience for you to go ahead and hold up the line.
Right.
You know, and there are four ways to get it wrong.
So, I mean, when I'm at a restaurant, am I going to have to tell the waitress, hold on, let me go to where you swipe the card, and I'll show you how to swipe it so we can get this done. Like what?
Well, and this is what's going to happen with EMV, right? Because when I had friends from England come over and took them out to a restaurant, and at one point they wanted to pay because I'd been buying meals. It was their turn to pay, whatever. And in the UK, you present your card. The waitress or waiter, the server, brings over a portable terminal, and you insert the EMV into the EMV slot right there at the table. The card never leaves your sight, never leaves your presence. And in the US restaurant, they take the card and go off in the back room, and they were what the hell? They stole my card. Where's my card gone? It's out of my sight. And
well, that's a cultural thing. That's why it's chip and signature and not chip and pin, because we like signing for our cards here, even though you could put hieroglyphics in there. Yeah.
Stupid.
Nobody's checking the signature. Nobody cares. You can write anything on there.
Yeah, and it was a disastrous mistake that we went for chip and signature instead of chip and pen.
So I use Apple Pay a lot, but I have a funny EMV story. I was in Florida, and I was at a Walmart, and they have the EMV readers there.
They have
Injecto.
So it
rejected the swipe on my card because it's a chip card that I had already gotten, right?
Hmm.
And so I had never used it before. I didn't know how it worked. And so they were like, oh, you put it in this little slot here. So you have to push it in, and then it like locks into place, right?
Yeah.
And then it gives it a little click when you push the card in there, and then it reads the chip. Well, I didn't know that you're just to leave it in there until the transaction's complete. I figured you just pop it in, and then it says good to go, and then you pop it out, and that's it. So I popped the card in there, and then I popped it out, and it crashed the whole system.
Yeah.
So people are lined up behind me, and the woman behind the counter doesn't know what the hell's going on. I don't know what the hell's going on because I've never used it before.
Right.
She's trying to ring up the transaction, and everybody behind me just kind of throws their stuff on the ground and says, forget it, I'm not paying for it, and they all left the store. So I'm sure Walmart hates me, but so the whole system broke down because I prematurely pulled out my chip card.
Well, and you pulled it out because that's what you were taught to do with magstripe stuff. You insert it and you remove.
Right, and that's it, yeah.
But because it's a chip, it needs to be in there so it can boot the chip and read the chip.
But what was interesting to me
is
it knew that it was a swipe card, so it rejected the swipe on the reader. So what I'm wondering is, if I have a chip card and I replicate the swipe into a coin and I take it to one of those machines, is it going to outright reject the swipe because it's spoofing a chip card?
Potentially. That's a very good question.
Nobody knows how this stuff works, right? So who's going to spend $100 on a product where you need to learn how to swipe it, you don't know if it's going to work after October when the switch change takes place and everybody's on EMV machines? I mean, I can't see this product being a big success.
So we've gone from it's really awesome, I want it, to catastrophe.
No, well, I want to try it. I'm excited to use it. I mean, I didn't pay for it. It's just getting mailed to me. So, why not?
I mean, those are the reasons why I was kind of down on it at first. But after using it, it's convenient for me and will be convenient for the next couple years, I'm assuming, until the battery dies. And then That'll be it. I mean, by that time, it might be obsolete. So,
is there any chance of the credit card companies playing nice with this thing? I mean, it doesn't seem like they.
Well, unless one of the companies buys Coin and their technology, then I don't really.
No, but there is similar company. There's a similar thing to Coin that got bought by Samsung. Yes, remember that?
Right. Yeah. Yeah, and it spoofs, and that's crazy technology.
They're sending it out over magnetics to get to the head reader of the Stripe.
Right, it's pretty crazy. And that's neat stuff, but if you don't work partnerships with these credit card companies, it's not going to work. Like you can see with Google Wallet versus Apple Pay. Apple went and worked out deals with the credit card companies, played nice with them, let them keep their point systems and all that stuff. They didn't try to change a system that people generally like. And so Apple Pay is catching on in a way that Google Wallet never caught on. And so now they have Google Pay or Android Pay or whatever the heck they're calling it. And they're doing the exact same thing Apple did, because you got to play nice with these credit card companies. They have all the power, and people like their points and they like the systems. And you know, you can say whatever you want about credit card companies, but they got a lot of power and they got a lot of clout. This is a product that at first blush seems like it's almost a security issue for me, right? I mean, you're spoofing a credit card. It seems like the credit card companies aren't going to want to play nice with this product, and they're going to do whatever they can to block it out. And so I would not be surprised if come October you run into systems like I did in Walmart where it rejected the swipe.
Well, yeah. You get it and report back to us, because I'd like to hear.
Yeah, I'm curious, because I haven't actually seen any EMV readers in New York that have rejected it. I guess they've been slower to update here. So I'm going to have to go out of my way to find an EMV reader and see how that goes.
I don't think I've ever seen one here.
Yeah, really? It was weird. And I saw two of them back to back. I went from a Walmart. It was a Walmart liquor store, and then I went next door to a Firehouse Subs, and both of them had EMV readers. So by the time I went to Firehouse, I knew how to do the thing, and I didn't prematurely remove my card. But I broke the system at Walmart, and everybody just left.
Yeah. So here's the thing,
Verifone,
right?
Dealer was busy on that block.
So there are Verifones, and the Verifones are popular with a lot of the smaller merchants. There's also the big Verifone that's the one in Target and the same one that's used in Trader Joe's. The Ingenico that you saw at Walmart is a smaller one, and I don't see that Ingenico much anywhere, basically.
We're talking about point of sale.
We're talking about point of sale PIN pads and EMV readers and mag stripes. And the thing is that a lot of merchants are going to get Apple Pay support unintentionally or sort of on the backside of things by virtue of upgrading to a point of sale system that allows the EMV slot that they have to do.
Right.
Because the way that Verifone sells these things is they have the model, and the model has they have two basic models of the same thing. And one of them has the NFC chip populated and the other does not. And for the one that does, most of those work with Apple Pay. Some do not, just because whoever's programming the thing simply hasn't flashed it to enable it.
Or they've flashed it to disable it in some cases here.
Right. But for many merchants, if the people selling the system to the merchant is at all clued in, and unfortunately many of them are not, you can get NFC working. You can have the thing happen without an issue. I've gone into small merchants, mom and pop shops, and been able to Apple Pay once I taught them how to use their point of sale system.
This is why I'm excited about Coin, because I'm an insane person, and I am the type of person who called and complained to Capital One that their new chip card they send me is an embossed card with raised numbers on it, as opposed to the old card, which was unembossed.
You are insane.
I am insane, because I used to have a metal wallet that could only hold so many cards, and if you had unembossed cards, it could hold twice as many cards, because people don't realize those raised numbers make the card twice as thick. And so I called and complained. Nobody cares. Nobody's going to listen to me. But if I can cut down on that extra centimeter of space in my wallet, because now I have a leather wallet, but the numbers on the cards will actually leave an indentation on the leather. So I like the idea of not only cutting down on the cards, but having the thinness and all that. So I'm an insane person, and I'm excited about Coin. But I don't think it's going to be a successful product.
I love it in theory, but I hate it in theoretical usage.
Right. I'll say we'll see how it is when I get my hands on it. But I'm excited to try it.
And on that note, this concludes episode 26 of our show, recording on Thursday, July 23rd. We had with us Neil Hughes, managing editor.
Thanks for having me, guys.
And Mikey.
Yes.
That's your cue to say yes. Thanks for having me.
I know. I thought I'd.
Oh, you're bringing it up with yes. Okay. Yeah. I've been your host, Victor. And if Neil loves Coin and his EMV slot locks up and steals his card, we'll let you know about it next time on the Apple Insider Podcast.